Okay, well, as we mentioned, you know, next week, Rocky will be back with us, and he'll be teaching the final lesson in our series, The Harmony of the Gospels. Hard to believe that it's been almost a full year that we've been involved in this study. And, you know, just as the Gospel writers devoted the greatest percentage of their writings to Holy Week, which is that period from Palm Sunday to Friday when Jesus was crucified and then buried, and then Easter Sunday, the day that he rose from the dead. Just as they devoted the largest percentage of their writing to that topic, in the same way, we have been spending considerable time focusing on that particular week. In fact, we've been in Holy Week since April. I don't know if you remember that, but... Well, the last time that we met as a group, Rocky taught on the passages describing Jesus' burial. And you might recall that from 2 weeks ago. And certainly the period from Jesus' arrest through his crucifixion and burial is an interval where it appeared from a human perspective that things were tragically gone wrong. It seemed like the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the chief priests had won. That Jesus was dead, the disciples were scattered, their movement, if you want to call it that, was defeated. And it appeared that the religious authorities were the ones who were in control. But as Rocky reminded us, that was not the case at all, that God was fully in control, very much in control. And as we're going to see this morning, the exclamation point that the Lord places on that that concept of his control occurs in our passages this morning as Jesus raised from the dead. And this morning we want to consider this subject from three different perspectives. One is we want to take a look at the accounts of the resurrection. So that's what we're going to spend the first few minutes of class on, is just the accounts of the resurrection themselves. And secondly, we want to talk a little bit about the evidence for the resurrection. And then thirdly, we want to talk about why it's important. Why is the resurrection important? And why are these accounts so significant? And so we want to start just by reading this week's passages. You know, normally our practice has been to perhaps select one portion of the week's readings and then just kind of focus on that on Sunday morning. But I thought this week it might be most appropriate to look at all four accounts of the resurrection. And we're going to read through all four of them and look at how they differ from each other and how they fit together or don't fit together, as you may find. And if you turn to Matthew 28, we'll look at the first passage. And I need a volunteer to read, some brave soul who will read the first 10 verses of Matthew 28. Larry. Okay, thanks, Larry. Well, now if you turn over to Mark chapter 16, we'll look at Mark's account of the same event. And would somebody like to read just the first 8 verses of Mark 16? Mike, would you be one to do that? Sure. Salome, yeah, that's, yeah, that works. Okay.
Very early on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen. They were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us at the entrance of the tomb?" Looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled away, although it was extremely large. Entering the tomb, they saw a young man them, "Do not be amazed. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who has been crucified. He is risen. He is not here. Behold, here is the place where they laid him. You go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." They went out and fled to the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had gripped them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid.
All right, and how about Luke chapter 24, first 12 verses? Anybody else want to? Tom, thanks.
But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they came to the tomb, bringing the spices which they had prepared. And they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were perplexed about this, behold, two men suddenly stood near them in dazzling clothing. And as the women were terrified and bowed their faces to the ground, the men said to them, "Why do you seek the living? There's a living one among the dead. He is not here, but he has risen. Remember how he spoke to you while he was still in Galilee, saying that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again." And they remembered his words. And he returned from the tomb and reported all these to the 11 and to all the rest. Now they were Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Mary, the mother of James. Also the other women with them were telling these things to the apostles. But these words appeared to them as nonsense, and they would not believe them. But Peter got up and ran to the tomb. Stooping and looking in, he saw the linen wrappings only, and he went away to his home, marveling at what had happened.
All right. And then the last passage is in the Gospel of John, chapter 20. And I'll read this one. It's verses 1 through 10. Actually, I'm going to cheat a little bit and maybe read a couple of extra verses, which are really part of next week's reading, but I think it helps to tie the accounts together. John 20. "Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came early to the tomb while it was still dark and saw the stone already taken away from the tomb. So she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to them, 'They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him.' So Peter and the other disciple went forth, and they were going to the tomb. The two were running together, and the other disciple ran ahead faster than Peter and came to the tomb first. And stooping and looking in, he saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he did not go in. And so Simon Peter also came, following him, and entered the tomb, and he saw the linen wrappings lying there, and the face cloth which had been on his head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. So the other disciple, who had first come to the tomb, then also entered, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not understand the scripture, that he must rise again from the dead. So the disciples went away again to their own homes. But Mary was standing outside the tomb weeping. And so, as she wept, she stooped and looked into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the feet, where the body of Jesus had been lying. And they said to her, 'Woman, why are you weeping?' And she said to them, 'Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him.'" Now, obviously, if we were to continue reading that passage, we'd find that then Jesus speaks to her, but that's next week, so you'll need to come and hear what Rocky has to share about the Jesus' resurrection appearances. Well, when you take those four accounts and you place them side by side, and, you know, without doing quite a bit of page flipping, it's a little bit hard to do that, but they're familiar passages. You, I think, are well acquainted with them. But when you consider the four of them side by side, how do they strike you? Do they sound like they mesh perfectly and they're all saying exactly the same thing? Or do you find that there's some differences? What are some differences that come to mind?
One angel or two angels.
Yeah, how many angels are there? You know, one of the gospel writers says that there was one, and other gospel writers say there were two. Well, what's the real story? Yeah, it doesn't seem like it quite fits together. Well, what else?
Angel inside the tomb or outside?
Where was the angel? Matthew says that he was on top of the rock, and The other accounts, the angel is inside the tomb. Where's the angel? What else? Yeah. Right. Matthew mentions the guards and their reaction. The others, it sounds like the guards aren't even there. What else?
Which women were there? Lots of different ones mentioned, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's women that were there, and we've established that much, but which ones? Kind of depends. Your conclusion would depend on which gospel account you read. You know, was it just Mary Magdalene? She's the only one that's mentioned in the Gospel of John. But we also find Mary, the mother of James the Less, and she's also referred to as the other Mary. We find Joanna. We find Salome. And then Luke says, and there were other women. So, you know, which is it? Anything else strike you as, you know, a little bit tricky on how to put these things together? Yeah. Yeah, the timing doesn't seem like, you know, at first glance that it really fits together. Let's see. I guess the whole question of Mary Magdalene, you know, what's going on with Mary? You know, when you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Mary is with the other women, and it sounds like she's hearing what the angels have to say, and then you read the Gospel of John, and Mary doesn't even seem to understand that Jesus has risen from the dead. She's weeping. Well, which is it? You know, when you look at all these things, I guess another one, maybe a final one that was on my list. What about with Peter and John? When you read the synoptic accounts, it sounds like Peter and John are with the other of the 11. They're kind of all gathered together as a group. And yet you read in the Gospel of John, and Peter and John go to the tomb individually. How do you square that? Well, I can remember not long after I came to faith in the Lord, I was in a weeknight Bible study group, and one of the topics that kind of came up for discussion was this whole question of how these gospel accounts seem to differ so much, and it seems so hard to put them together. It seems like they contradict each other, and it really bothered me. I couldn't understand, you know, why that would be the case. And there was a woman in that particular Bible study who was much older in the faith than I was at that time. And, you know, she made the point that, in her mind, the discrepancies that you find here merely underscore the fact that these are eyewitness accounts of a dramatic event. And that's kind of what happens with people. You know, you bring them into a situation and something dramatic happens, and then you can interview five people and you'll get five different accounts of what happened. And her implication was, well, you know, don't sweat the details. Don't get hung up on the details. It's okay if some of the information is contradictory, that just proves that these are real accounts and not stories that were fabricated. Because if they had been fabricated, then they would all fit together perfectly. And she said, you know, when people witness any dramatic event and all the excitement, they're never going to get all the points quite right. But the main thing is the tomb was empty, and that's all that matters. Well, that was kind of her explanation, and I found that answer to be terribly unsatisfying. I thought, well, how can that be? You know, if you consider that the reason that the accounts are different is because these guys were all excited in what was happening, and so they're not seeing things quite right, and so they write down these accounts that don't really mesh together and, in fact, are contradictory, but, you know, we shouldn't worry about that. Just look at the main point. Well, if they don't have the details right, then who's to say that the empty tomb itself is a reliable fact. So I never did buy her argument. You know, now there's an aspect of the point that she's making that's true, and it is true that if there is an event and you get a number of witnesses together, they're probably going to give you somewhat different reports of what they saw, but they may all be perfectly factual, but they may not have all observed the same kinds of things. You know, one of the things that Barb's family does on an annual basis is they have a family reunion in Western Pennsylvania, and it's always a camping weekend where everybody kind of, well, they used to arrive on Friday. Now they arrive on Thursday because they're making it a bigger event. But they get there on Thursday and depart on Sunday, and then Saturday is always the big deal. They have a meal where everybody comes and everybody brings something. And if we had returned from a reunion and you were to ask me and then ask Barb, what happened at reunion, some of the points you would probably pick up on is that if you asked me what happened at reunion, I would tell you how many people were there. And if you asked Barb, she would probably tell you who was there. If you asked me, I would tell you what we had to eat at the reunion dinner. If you asked Barb, she would tell who she visited with at the reunion dinner. If you asked me, I would tell you that the highlight was Uncle Wayne showing us his new pickup truck. And if you asked Barb, she would tell you about Uncle Wayne's suffering with arthritis. And so, you could listen to the two of us, and you would know that we're both at the same event, but you're going to get a different set of facts because, we're going to take into consideration who it is that's asking us the questions, and we're coming from different perspectives, and the people that we're talking to are going to be coming from different perspectives. And in the same way, that's exactly how it is with the gospel writers. We talked about that at length when we first started this course almost a year ago. The fact that Matthew is a Jew and he's writing primarily to Jews. Mark is a Gentile and he's writing primarily to a Roman audience. And so they have different perspectives on things. And it's not that what they're saying isn't true. It's just that they are going to include facts or omit facts depending on what the point is that they're trying to make to the audience that they're writing to. So just as a small illustration of that, you'll notice that one of the things that Matthew does is he mentions the fact that there are two angels. Mark doesn't. Mark just mentions one angel. Well, you remember Matthew is the one who's coming from a Jewish background where it's important to have two witnesses to any event. That's how you prove that something is true. There's two witnesses. And so Matthew includes that fact. Well, I think there really were two angels there. But to Mark, that's not important. To Mark, what's important is, well, what did the angel say? And so Mark just focuses on the angel that did the talking, and he records what the angel said. And so you can see that it really is possible to put these accounts together. Well, you're kind of buying an assumption I'm making maybe at this point. Let's see if it's possible to put these accounts together in a way that they really do fit, and it does justice to all of them. There have been lots of efforts to do that over the centuries. Lots of writers have attempted to do it. And what I've done during this past week is sat down with these four accounts to see if I, in my own mind, could put together a sequence of events that would do justice to all four of the gospel accounts without contradicting any of them. And here's what I came up with. It would be fun to do this as an exercise in class, but it would probably take us over an hour to do it. So I'm going to save us some time. Now, as I go down through this, you can pick your favorite gospel account and see if it indeed fits with what I'm presenting here. Well, here's a harmony, a possible way to harmonize these accounts. First event, when the Sabbath ended on sundown on Saturday, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome, who's, by the way, she's the mother of James and John, the sons of thunder, bought spices so they could finish the task of anointing Jesus' body with spices. That's Mark 16:1. So as soon as the Sabbath ended, so we're talking about Saturday evening, that's when they go out to buy the spices. They would have been available to purchase at that point in time. Well, then they, along with Joanna and several other women, because Luke mentions that there were other women, but he doesn't name them, agreed to meet at Jesus' tomb at daybreak to perform this task. So perhaps they had made an agreement that they are all going to gather together at the tomb. Well, early Sunday morning, while it was still dark, Jesus rose from the dead, his body passing right through the wrappings and possibly right through the stone of the tomb. And the resurrection occurred, but nobody actually witnessed that particular event. At least we have no record of it. Third point, probably at the same time, an earthquake shook the ground as an angel rolled the stone back from the entrance to the tomb. Matthew records that there was an earthquake, possibly very localized, as the stone was rolled back. One point here, the stone was not rolled back to let Jesus out. Would Jesus need to have an angel do that for him? Obviously not. It's something one of the commentators mentioned, and something I hadn't really thought about before. I guess I had always pictured the angel rolling the stone back and then Jesus coming out, and that is not the case. In fact, Jesus may have already been risen and gone at the time that the angel rolled the stone back. We're not told that. The angel, whose appearance was like lightning and whose garment was white as snow, that's in Matthew's account, sat upon the stone. The guards witnessed this event and were struck with terror, becoming like dead men. That's also Matthew. After the guards recovered their senses, they fled the scene, and later some of them reported to the chief priests everything they had witnessed. That's in Matthew's gospel. It's not part of the reading that we had for today. The chief priests bribed them to say the body was stolen by the disciples while they were sleeping at their post. The guards accepted the offer and spread the false report. Again, that's in Matthew's gospel. Next, Mary Magdalene was the first of the women to arrive in the area of the tomb, and it was still dark. You'll notice that in John chapter 20, verse 1, it says that Mary Magdalene arrived there, and it was dark. She had not yet approached the tomb itself. My guess is that she arrived in the tomb area, but was not really at the tomb. She was perhaps at a meeting place where the other women, where she would meet the other women as they arrived. As the sun began to rise, the other women arrived, and the group of women began to discuss among themselves who would roll the stone away for them. But as they approached the tomb, they found the stone had already been rolled away. So now Mary Magdalene has joined up with the other group of women, and together they have found that the stone has been rolled away. The women entered the tomb, but did not find the body of Jesus. Mary Magdalene then left the group and immediately ran to tell Peter and John that the body had been stolen. Remember, Mary's conclusion when she sees the empty tomb is, they've taken the body, and we don't know what they've done with it. So apparently, she splits off from the group, and she goes and tells Peter and John that the body had been stolen. Meanwhile, the other women remained at the tomb. Two angels appeared to them inside the tomb. And we've already discussed the fact that, you know, Mark says there was one. Well, it's because Mark, I think, is just recording the fact that one was speaking. But the other accounts indicate there were two. They looked like men. Did you notice that also? You know, it says that there was a young man in the tomb. I think that's Mark's account. It doesn't say that he's an angel. So I think they are angels who look like men, but their garments were dazzling white, and that's something that all four accounts indicate. The women were terrified. One of the angels spoke and told them not to fear, that Jesus had risen just as he said he would, and that they should immediately tell the disciples, and that Jesus would go before them to Galilee and they would see him there. So the women, minus Mary Magdalene, are getting this explanation from the angel. So the group of women, minus Mary Magdalene, left the tomb and headed off to tell the disciples. When Mary Magdalene arrives where the disciples are and tells Peter and John that the body has been stolen, and after telling them, then she departs. Moments later, the group of women arrive and tell the disciples about the empty tomb and the appearing of the angels. They give the angels' message, but they're met with skepticism by the disciples. But having just heard the report from Mary Magdalene, followed by a second report from the other women, Peter and John run to the tomb to investigate. John outruns Peter, but remains outside the tomb. Peering in, he sees the linen wrappings there, but does not go in. When Peter arrives, he goes in and finds the linens lying there, with a face cloth rolled up and lying separately. John then enters and observed the scene and believed. Then Mary returns to the tomb a second time, still weeping, still believing that the body had been stolen. Those were those last few verses that I read in the Gospel of John. She enters the tomb and observes the two angels there who tell her that Jesus has risen. And we'll stop at that point, because then we get into the resurrection appearances, and that's next week's lesson. But that's at least one possible way that you could put the sequence together and find that all four gospel accounts would fit into this particular sequence. Now, am I saying that this is actually the way it happened? I don't know, because we're not given enough information to be able to piece everything together and be certain. But the point that I'm making is, it is possible to take all four of these accounts, and even though they sound quite different from each other, they mesh together perfectly. And what you wind up with is a whole that fits and it makes sense and there are no contradictions. Well, why is that important? Why does it matter that these accounts fit together? You know, like the lady that told me, oh yeah, there's some contradictions here, but don't worry about it. Well, we need to worry about it. Well, why? Well, obviously it's because the resurrection is the bedrock on which our faith is found. It's the bedrock on which it's established. And it had better stand up to close scrutiny, because if we can disprove the resurrection, if anyone can disprove the resurrection, then our faith amounts to nothing. It means we're just kind of living in a house of cards. We're fooling ourselves. Well, so that's the accounts of the resurrection. And we've seen that they are reliable historical accounts. They aren't contradictory. They do fit together. But what about the evidence itself? You know, there's been many attempts over the centuries to disprove Jesus' resurrection. And what evidence from these passages would you give them? You know, if somebody were to throw up in your face, you know, some of these arguments that they don't think Jesus rose from the dead. You know, one of the classic ones, in fact, it's even recorded in the Gospel of Matthew. One of the classic ones is, well, what really happened is the disciples went there and they stole the body. And the reason they did that is that they were power hungry and they were out to establish this new movement and, you know, establish themselves as leaders. And so this whole thing was just fabricated. If somebody were to present that view to you, what evidence from these passages would you point to say that doesn't make sense? It doesn't fit with the record. It doesn't fit with the testimony. How would you deflate that argument if somebody said, well, it's just a case of the disciples took the body? Could that have really happened? I see some heads going now. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Joe's mentioned two problems, you know, with that theory. Yeah, one is that the body is wrapped. You know, and who's going to want to take the body and unwrap it? I don't think so. I mean, if you're going to take a body, wouldn't you just take it as is? You know, and you could still claim that Jesus had risen from the dead and he took his wrappings with him when he did. I mean, yeah, it doesn't seem to make sense that they would unwrap the body. And then Joe also mentioned the guards. Yeah, who's there at the tomb? You know, if the disciples were to show up and snatch the body, what's going to happen? They're going to meet with a little resistance, maybe more than a little resistance. Yeah, you know, we've got armed Roman guards there who are going to prevent that from happening. So, you know, that concept just doesn't really seem to make any sense. Remember, too, that the tomb had been sealed with an official seal. How are they going to get the body? You know, if let's say, okay, well, maybe the guards were sleeping and they went in and stole the body. Well, how are they going to move the stone without the guards hearing it? You know, is that going to make sense? I don't really think so. What does the record say about the mindset of the disciples during this whole time? We didn't really look at that this morning, but are they a bold bunch that's going to go and take charge of things? They're in hiding, yeah. Yeah, quite the opposite. So that doesn't seem to fit at all either. And suppose they did steal the body in order to make this claim that Jesus rose from the dead, and now they're establishing this new religion. What hope do they have for eternity? None. Yeah, I mean, there's just nothing. There's the whole thing is a lie. They're dead in their sins and trespasses. You know, why bother? Why would they go through the exercise? It just doesn't make any sense. So you can see there's evidence here that the resurrection really happened, or at least that the disciples didn't take the body. Well, there would be others that would argue, okay, well, the disciples didn't take the body, but what really happened was when Jesus was hanging on the cross, then they thought he was dead. He really wasn't dead. You know, he just swooned. He just fainted. And they were mistaken when they placed him in the tomb. And then he revived, he recovered and exited the tomb. Some of you are laughing. You know, what would you say to that argument? I mean, that has been one of the historical arguments against the resurrection. Yeah, that is this small matter of the stone and the guards and the seal, and what kind of physical condition is he in? Yeah. Yeah, what else would make it difficult for Jesus to, from the inside, escape the tomb and claim that he had risen from the dead? Yeah. Yeah, there would be some evidence, wouldn't there? What else would make it difficult for him? He's wrapped up. Yeah. Right. Right, you know, the text says that, you know, you're talking about dozens of pounds of spices, and then he's wrapped, and where is one of the wrappings? Around his face. Yeah, there's a face wrapping. Well, can you imagine trying to recover from the ordeal of hanging on the cross for 6 hours, and doing so when your face is wrapped? You know, just obviously it doesn't make any sense. So again, there's evidence here that would totally defeat that argument. Yeah, good point. Well, here's another argument. This is the last one we'll talk about. Another argument has been, well, what really happened was the women went to the wrong tomb. You see, they arrived there, it was still dark, and they went to the wrong tomb, and they were just mistaken. And so they went to this tomb, and, you know, the stone had rolled back, and it was empty, and it's because it was just a vacant tomb, and they were in the wrong address. Arguments? You're saying Veronica doesn't let you get away with much? Is that? Yeah. 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 Ah, touche. What's that? Yes. Yeah, because the women weren't the only ones that went there, but Peter and John went there also, and they would have had to go to the wrong location, so that doesn't make any sense. There's one other thing. We didn't read it today, but it was in the reading for last time, which you may or may not recall, and that's that, you remember when Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus were burying the body? They weren't alone. Some of the women were there, observing.